Okay, so what have we seen so far? We started studying this Heisenberg spin chain. So it's a spin chain with nearest neighbors interaction. And where a very simple state of that spin chain is the state where all spins are up. If everyone is up, permuting the spins does nothing, identity does nothing, so that's definitely an eigenstate of our Hamiltonian whose energy is zero. On top of that ferromagnetic vacuum, we can start putting n spin flips, which mean n magnons, and we found some exact equations, there's no approximation, so you can solve this equation, you can put L equals 10, n equals 5, or n equals 4, or n equals 3, you just solve them in a computer, and you can solve them with 200 digits, and that gives the exact energy with 200 digits. So there's no approximation there, it's just an exact set of equations. And the spin is L over 2, which is everyone up, and then each time you flip a spin, you lose a one spin 1/2, you get a spin minus 1/2, so the difference is 1. So these magnons, they carry 1 unit of spin. Then yesterday, or Friday, we derived a set of effective approximate equations, approximate because they are only valid at large L. Those equations, you cannot just plug L equals 10 or L equals 20. They are valid at large L. And they describe the antiferromagnetic vacuum. There, the excitations are called spinons rather than magnons. And the equations take the same form as the equations above, where this term that I would call here e to the I moment of the magnon times L, right, the propagation of the magnon, now it's moment of the spinon times L, S matrix of spinons, energy of spinons. So exactly the same form, where I replace magnon by spinons. Except that the expressions we got for the momentum, energy, and S matrix of the spinon, they look more complicated. Right? So the spinons, the S matrix of two magnons, is just U minus V plus I, U minus V minus I. That's it. Right? It's just this simple rational function. The S matrix of the spinon has four gamma functions. Right? More complicated. It's a more interesting object, right? The energy and the moment are given by these expressions. Okay? Now, I just want to point out that these expressions, they look quite complicated, but in Fourier, they are very simple. That's how we derive them from convolution. So I just want to emphasize that these seemingly complications, they just came because we went back to theta space. In Fourier, everything is simple. For example, the Fourier transform of the energy, of that energy there, is just it's just this combination, which is the same as 1 over 2 cosh omega over 2. And for the S matrix, we get just this simple expression. Okay? So it is just the Fourier transform of this gives 4 psi functions, where psi is the derivative of log of gamma function. And when I integrate, I get that S matrix. Okay, this is for the derivative. Sorry, derivative of log. The derivative of log of S matrix has a very simple Fourier transform. And then I integrate and exponentiate, and I get those gamma functions. The momentum was the derivative of the momenta was the energy, remember? Because if I take the derivative of the momenta, the derivative of this factor here, I get this factor here. I get this Lorentzian here. So the momentum and the energy, they are related. One is just the derivative of the other. And that goes through, that the identity goes through, so the Fourier transform of these two expressions, they are actually related. In other words, if I take a derivative with respect to theta, this is nothing but the derivative with respect to theta of the momentum. This relation is inherited from the fact that this was already the case in the spinon case, in the magnon case. Okay. And where do these equations come about, these Fourier transform equations? They came, I remind you, from the continuum limit of bit equations for the magnons. We said, let's put many, 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 many magnons here. We take the logarithm of these equations. Instead of 1, we get e to the 2 pi I times an integer. Right? That integer counts which root I am. And in the continuum limit, that label becomes a smooth parameter. And I take the derivative of the equations with respect to u. And the derivative of the index gives me the density, how many particles am I including whenever I'm changing the index? If some numbers are not used, these were called holes, and depending on yesterday or Friday, we did a case with m equals 0 first and then m equals 2, 2, where there were two holes there. So this, I jump, and the derivative of a jump is just delta function. So that's the position of the holes. And then we have derivative of momenta, which actually is the energy, which has a very simple Fourier transform. And then we have this convolution, remember this integral of u minus v, where this k is the derivative of log of the S matrix. And you see that all these objects, they have very simple Fourier transform. The Fourier transform of the derivative of the momenta, it is just this exponential with omega over 2. And the Fourier transform of log of the S matrix, because S matrix and momenta, they differ by just some I over 2 becoming some I, is the same Lorentzian, but with a different parameter. So it's e to the minus omega only. So in Fourier, we just went to Fourier, everything became multiplication, and in this way we solved this equation. More precisely, what we found, what we did yesterday, what we did on Friday, if you think a little bit, what are we saying is the following. We are saying that the density for the anti-ferromagnetic vacuum, for example, first, let's call this maybe rho zero, not to keep writing so much, is what? Is if I put rho on the same side, what we did was we inverted 1 over 1 plus this kernel, k, and we acted with this inverse on L over 2 pi times p prime, which as we said is nothing but L over 2 pi times epsilon. Can you see properly? I'm seeing this. It's okay? Can you see? There is something wrong with the lights today. Yeah? Okay. Right? So this is the expression where we invert some kernel. We were just fortunate that we knew how to invert it by going to Fourier. So this inversion literally means 1 over 1 plus Fourier transform of the kernel times Fourier transform of this. In Fourier, it's just multiplication of the Fourier transforms. And you see the energy as e to the minus omega over 2. This k is e to the minus omega. And you put everything together, and you get 1 over cosh of 2 omega, which was the density we found. Now, once you write it in this way, remember, for example, what is the energy of the antiferromagnetic vacuum? Well, that is just basically integrating the energy epsilon of u, which means you take epsilon and you integrate it times rho, which I can write as rho convoluted with epsilon, in the sense that rho is a function, in the sense of integration, a vector of these two. And rho, on the other hand, is this expression. So I can write this expression as saying that I have epsilon I convolute with 1, 1 plus k, and then I have epsilon again, up to some factor of L over 2 pi. Okay. Where this epsilon was p prime. And this was what was giving this L times 2 log 2, which in the tutorial you saw that numerically was a very good approximation to our density. Okay. Then we saw that when we put the sources, we get that term over there, when we put the sources. And then, if you will remember the logic we saw yesterday, again, to find some effective, these effective equations, what we have is that the energy of the spinon is equal to 1 over 1 plus k times the energy of the magnon. The momentum of the spinon is 1 over 1 plus k times the momentum of the magnet, but that's just the integration of that relation. And the S matrix of the spinon is equal to 1 over 1 plus k times the S matrix of the magnet. So in other words, everything, no, sorry, this last expression is wrong, logarithm of the S matrix is this expression times logarithm of S. So in other words, what we have is this operation of inverting the kernel. That's the only non-trivial thing. That's the operation, this inversion of the kernel, is the operation that sends you from one vacuum to the other. Once you know how to do this operation, you apply it to various physical quantities to get all the physics around the antiferromagnetic vacuum. Because this is the operation that tells you how non-trivial is the vacuum and on the antiferromagnetic vacuum, how non-trivial it is to put all these magnets to go to the vacuum. As soon as you know how to do this, then to act with different sources or to do different operations is pretty straightforward. What's hard is to go to the antiferromagnetic vacuum, which is what this inverse operation does. Okay? But you see that then in Fourier space, what I'm saying is that the Fourier transform of the magnet results and of the spinon results, the only difference is this quantity here, which in Fourier is 1 over 1 plus e to the minus omega. So you see that these objects, they look much more complicated than the corresponding magnet counterparts, but in Fourier they are the same up to addressing of this simple factor. Okay? So this is the dressing that transforms ferromagnetic quantities into antiferromagnetic quantities. So the recipe at the end of the day is just you take a ferromagnetic quantity that you want, you Fourier transform it, dress it by this simple factor, Fourier transform it back, and you get the quantities for the spinons. Okay. That's what we saw last time. Okay. Any question here? Yes.
Is there a simple interpretation for this factor, or?
This factor here was obtained what? Physically. Physically, it was related to putting many, many, many particles and finding what that density is. I can write all these expressions using now rho and so on. So this is finding the density of particles. So basically, what's happening here, if you want, one way of thinking is, what is the ferromagnetic spin and momentum? What's the momentum? How much momentum it costs to go around? It costs p minus kp plus k square p minus k cube p and so on. And you can think of that kp, that power series, as saying that the magnet, the spinon propagates, but it interacts with the vacuum. And this interaction with the vacuum, how many times it's interacting with an non-trivial vacuum would be this power expansion in k. So this is saying that the momentum now, it gets dressed by the interaction with the vacuum, and that gives me this. Remember, k is the S matrix, is related to the S matrix. So this is saying that the momenta now to go around, the simple action of the spinon going around is very non-trivial, because from a microscopic point of view, the spinon is scattering with all the magnets that are making the vacuum. And that, at the end of the day, I call effective momentum when it finished going around. Okay? Okay. The spin of this state, I remind you, is m over 2. So now, when m is equal to 0, we get spin 0, right? So when m is equal to 0, we are in the antiferromagnetic state, which has this energy. And when we start putting spinons, and we need to put an even number of them, as we saw yesterday, and we need to put an even number of them, each of them carries spin 1/2. Okay? The reason why we have one of them is because when we wrote the equations in log form, we saw that the integers that we could choose were bounded to go between minus something and plus something. So we had this idea of this maximum q, which was something like l over 2 minus n over 2. So when we put one less n, right, and this, I remind you, was because we had l times arctangent of uj, and this minus was because then we had minus sum over k not equal to j of 2 arc tangent of uj minus uk. So the more n we put, the less space we have. So when we put n to be l over 2, q max, the absolute value that this integer can have, is smallest, so we have less space. And we must fill all the integers. But then when you decrease n by 1, we get a little bit more space. So it's already good. And we have one less particle to put. So in total, we have 2 empty slots. Right? So because of this, we go from having no empty slots for anti, suddenly we get 2 slots for the first excitation, for the first excited state. And this 2 was basically this fractionalization that we said in the beginning. Now, this does not describe the full Hilbert space of the spin and system. Because, as someone pointed out, as you pointed out, there is not one solution for the antiferromagnetic state. Because there's not one singlet, there are a gazillion singlets. We just took one solution where all roots were real. Otherwise, we have complex roots and we have more solutions. And that's related to the fact that this cannot be the full answer, because we could want, for example, to explore the vicinity of the antiferromagnetic state staying within the singlets. No one tells us that I must go away from the singlets and start having some spin Z component, right? So exploring those other complex solutions, it's also important. So this treatment here, this is not yet complete. This part here is totally complete. This one here, not yet. We have to think a little bit more carefully. How do we explore the singlet subspace around to the antiferromagnetic state if we want it, for example? Is it clear? So that's what I would like to do now. But for that, I have to do first, I take one step backwards first and tell you a little bit more about these complex solutions of BT equations. So I would like to ask, is there any question here? No? Okay. So the question is, let's take L to be very large. We want to stay with L very large. And we want to ask, are there solutions with complex uj? Okay? Now we go back. And here, I'm thinking about the ferromagnetic Bittan-Zatz equation. Okay, so we want to ask if there are complex solutions there. And the idea is, let's consider, let U1 be the root with the biggest imaginary part. So the imaginary part of U1 is positive, and it's bigger than everyone else.
So why do you want ferromagnetic? You're exploring the antiferromagnetic effect.
We are exploring the antiferromagnetic, but we derived the antiferromagnetic equations under the assumptions that everyone was real. Okay? So I'm now taking a step back, as I said. So let's make a parenthesis here and go back to ferromagnetic physics. We'll do it for like 15 minutes. We go back to ferromagnetic physics for 15 minutes, and then we will go back to antiferromagnetic. Okay? Yeah, from a logical point of view, I should have done this before going into antiferromagnetic, but as I told you, I thought I had 4 lectures rather than 7, so I'm now inserting this piece of physics here. So let's consider you want to be the one with the largest imaginary part. Then you see that this factor, U1 plus I over 2 over U1 minus I over 2 to DL blows up, right? Goes to infinity. Because U1 has a positive imaginary part, so this absolute value is bigger than this absolute value. When I raise it to the power L, this goes to infinity. Is it clear? Yeah? If it's not clear for someone, tell. Okay? So this goes to infinity. So this looks already that I cannot solve those equations equal to 1. Okay? So can you find out a solution to this? How could I solve these equations? So this term blows up as soon as the imaginary part of U1 is positive. So the way out is, this implies that there must exist one of the other roots, say U2, which is approximately equal to what? I want that equation to work. I put there U1 plus I over 2, U1 minus I over 2, it explodes. So what should I try? I try to make one of those other factors very small, such that I have very large times very small, it can be equal to 1. So the only option is that I must find a U2 which is equal to U1 minus I. Okay? So I want to emphasize here something, which is, right, that this U2 here must be equal to U1 minus I. So this sign here, okay, minus I, if it was plus I, this would be totally different. The solutions of these equations are totally different. Indeed, imagine it was, so let's put here, this, let's put it all here, minus I. If the equations had plus I there, I would say plus I. If the equations had plus I there, right? Then I would just put here plus I. But that's impossible because U1 is the one with the biggest imaginary part. So U2 cannot be U1 plus I, otherwise U2 would have the biggest imaginary part. So if I have plus I, there are no complex solutions to this equation. If I have minus I, there are. So it's totally, we are lucky that we got that sign, so we have complex solutions.
Is there a yes. physical situation where it's plus I?
Yeah, there are other models where it is plus I, and in those models we don't have bound, we don't have complex solutions. Okay, so this means that in the complex plane, what we find is that we can have a U1 here, provided we have a U2 here. This separation is I, and this is I is a very, very good approximation. This is true with exponential precision, because things are blowing up exponential. So this is extremely precise to say that the separation between these two roots is I. It's a very, very good approximation. It's not even power law, it's exponentially good, right? Because this goes to infinity exponentially, so they need to be exponentially close to each other. Okay, and then we can have this complex, these two complex solutions, right? More generally, because no one tells us that they are centered around the real solution. More generally, the space of solutions will be something. Like there will be a bunch of real solutions. There can be a bunch of strings like this. They are called strings, separated by I. And there could also be some roots that form some bigger strings, even bigger if you want, and so on, where this separation between these roots is always I. And the physical meaning of these solutions, as we said the other day, I should think of these guys as saying that I have my ferromagnetic vacuum, and then I have a block of spins that is moving together, in this case, four spins. They are not exactly all together, but there is some kind of wave function that decays exponential when they start not being together. And this guy moves with some total momentum to the left and some total energy to the left. And the fact that we should expect this, I remind you, is because the energy inside is zero, the energy outside is zero, so it costs very little energy to form these blocks, so we should expect complex solutions to these equations. Okay. So we see that instead of having just uj's, what we should have, rather, is we should say we have uj, we have uj, a, where this would be the size, this would be the center of mass of the jth string of size A, such that the total number of roots is equal to the sum of how many roots there are of type A times A, because each string uses A roots. And where J, the index J here, A runs from 1 to infinity, and J runs from 1 to NA. Right? Where here J runs from 1 to N. Yes?
So how does the mechanism where you have a string of, say, 3, how does the mechanism you described on the left where U2 is approximately U1 minus I work? Like, I understand when there's pairs of the spins, but if there's three guys, how does it work? That, like, which are coupled to which through the minus I? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. So I'm saying that here there are now some, which ones are coupled? I mean, if you just have two pairs, if you have many pairs, you are not worried. You are worried about the case when I have four or five or something like this?
In particular.
Right. Input. So you say, I have here U1, say, or here U1, and I have here U2.
Mm-hmm.
Now, U2 still has a positive imaginary part.
Mm-hmm.
So now I go to the equation for U2,
mm-hmm.
and I find it still blows up.
I see. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
It still blows up, but be careful, because now there is a U1 here, which is also making it blow up in that case. So it blows up for two reasons. And then you need a U3 that cancels that. Mm-hmm. And now U3 has a negative imaginary part. You go there, and now it's the opposite. Now, okay, and once you have this, it must be reflection symmetric, because the equations are real. So you can always analyze the cases where if U1 is here, if U2 is the compass conjugate of U1, you can stop. But as soon as it's not the compass conjugate, you should continue until you get a reflection symmetric configuration. Okay. Okay, good. All right. Very good. Now, what happens if I want to write equations now for these guys, which are complex, where before, remember, we only considered the case where A equal to 1, right? How would we consider the energy of a string, for example? The energy of a string of size A is what? It is just, I take the energy of the center of mass of that string. This would be the center of mass of that string, right? So this is the position. So this, for example, it could be this, U, the center of the real part of that string. And what do? I have U, and I say it's the energy of each of its constituents plus I, J square, plus 1/4, where I sum over J equal to minus a minus 1 over 2 to a minus 1 over 2. I sum over all the elements of the string. For example, when a is 1, I have no sum, I have just 0. When a is 2, I get minus 1 half, 1 half. When a is 3, I get minus 1, 0, and 1, and so on. Do you agree? Right? And this expression, because this is just a derivative of the moment, it is just 1 over u plus I over 2 minus 1 over u minus I over 2 with some 1 over I, 1 over I, evaluated at u plus ij. Right? So you see it's a function f of u plus I over 2 minus a function f of u minus I over 2. So when I add up, there is telescoping, because I add up things spaced by I, so this guy cancels with the next, this guy cancels with the next, this guy cancels with the next, and only the first and last survive. So this sum is equal to A divided by U squared plus A squared over 4. Yeah, which is the first and the last term. So this is the energy of a string, and the momentum of the string is the same story. I multiply the I add up this factor for the string, but the string is also function of I over 2 minus function of minus I over 2, the log of this. So the log of the momentum of a string of size A, center of mass U, is just 1 over I, log of u plus I a over 2 over u minus I a over 2. So you see it's a very simple modification, these two expressions. If we put a equal to 1, you get what we had before, but otherwise this is what it is. Okay. What about the S matrix? The S matrix is more complicated, because now if I want to study the scattering between two of these bound states, so I want now to study the scattering between this object here and, say, this object here. So which would be this one here. And I want to study how these guys, one with momentum P, one with momentum K, would scatter with each other. Right? So how will they scatter with each other? I take the bit equations and I multiply the bit equations within a string and within a string. Right? So that I get equation for the center of mass. When I multiply the equations inside this string, I get e to the ip momentum of the string. Do you agree? Because I get moment of this guy, moment of this guy, moment of this guy, I get the full moment. The equations for the constituents, I don't care, because I already solved for the dynamics of the constituents. They're already separated by I. So now I only care about the center of mass, so I multiply this equation. And then, how do they scatter? There is the scattering of this guy with this guy, this guy with this guy, this guy with this guy, and so on. So I have a product of all possible scatterings of these four guys with these three guys. So the S matrix, S, A, B of U minus V, it's a little bit more complicated. It's a product where A runs from, J runs from minus A minus 1 over 2 to A minus 1 over 2. That's the constituent of the first string. Where K runs from minus A minus 1, B minus 1 over 2 to B minus 1 over 2. And then the first particle is U plus IJ. The second particle is V plus IK, and this is the scattering of their constituents, right? So I want to write here a few examples. Okay? So if I have A equal 1 and B equal 1, It is just a scattering of magnon with magnon. It's just U minus V plus I over U minus V minus I. If I scatter A equals 1 with B equals 2, means I scatter a fundamental magnon with a string. So A equals 1, there is no product over A. And the other one, I have a product of, I have two terms here. So you see one term gives I over 2, the other term gives 3I over 2 when I have here. So I get U minus V plus I over 2 times U minus V plus 3I over 2 divided by the complex conjugate. U minus V plus I minus I over 2, U minus V minus 3I over 2. And finally, I want to write the case when A is equal to 2 and B is equal to 2. Okay? Now there is one term where here I have 2, where here I have 1, here I have minus 1. No, where here I have 1 half, here I have minus 1 half, here I have I. So that biggest factor gives U minus V plus 2I. Over U minus V minus 2i. And then there is a U minus V plus I over U minus V minus I square. Okay? Yes?
How come you have different sign in front of I in the asymmetric here? Is this typo or is that really?
Here and here?
Then like in the original equations.
This and this?
Yeah.
Ah, you mean the fact that I changed I and minus I?
Uh-huh.
Ah, okay. Yeah, all these signs are wrong. So, 1 over S. Okay? Very good. Therefore, you see that in Fourier, it's very simple. So the kernel, this K in Fourier, remember, for 1, 1 is just the Fourier transform of that Lorentzian. A Lorentzian just Fourier transforms to e to the minus absolute value of omega. Right? You see what I'm doing, right? So it's u plus I over u minus I. The Fourier transform becomes u squared plus 1, 1 over u squared plus 1. Whose Fourier transform is e to the minus omega, right? So you see what I'm doing here? So d du of log of u minus I over u plus I is something like u square plus 1, okay, maybe 2. Okay, I'm not paying super attention, but I should perhaps. Yeah, but this Fourier transform is this because I pick the pole up, I pick the pole down, right? And the Fourier transform of this is this. Right? Is it clear? The residue is C is U minus I, U plus I. So the residue is 2. The 2 cancels the 2. And I get exactly this like we saw yesterday. Now, similarly, for K of the interaction between 1 and 2, we get two terms there. So in Fourier, it is just very simple. Omega over 2 plus e to the minus 3 omega over 2. And finally, string with string. Now we have e to the minus omega plus 2 e to the minus, e to the minus 2 omega plus 2 e to the minus omega. Okay? Cool. Okay. Now, and you see that, okay. Thank you. So let me see if there is anything I should write. I should probably write. So they. So let me just say, so again, let's summarize. So the energy is what? It's the sum over the energy of all strings. So A runs from 1 to infinity. That can be strings of any size. Then for each size, I sum from J equal 1 to the number of strings that there are. So if there is only strings of type 1, there's only N1. And then I get the energy of string of type A with center of mass U, J, comma A. Right. Where, so now we are starting to write some more precise equations, where the bit equations tell me that if I take the string of size A and carry that string around, it scatters, and I have to scatter that string with any other string with center of mass K and B, where I make product over everyone except that KB should not be equal to JA. So I don't scatter within the same string, but otherwise I scatter over everyone. And this is equal to 1. Okay? Now, strictly speaking, it should be approximate equal, but I don't even want to write it, but it's a different kind of approximation compared to the antiferromagnetic. So because this is much more precise. So this is with exponential precision. Okay, so here it's almost, I mean, if L is 20, it's already e to the minus 20, already got many, many digits. Whereas the antiferromagnetic equations we got there were polynomial precision. So that we were replacing sums by integrals and stuff like this. This is something you get, it's not exponentially precise. Okay? Okay, good. So now that we have these equations, we could now imagine taking these equations and taking the continuum limit and going to the antiferromagnetic physics, right? Okay? And then getting some effective equations for our spinners. Okay, so at this point you have to believe me, and we will see why it looks reasonable, that what we should consider in doing this, so what is relevant, is the case where N1 and N2 are not equal to 0, and all other N's are equal to 0. So yesterday we did N1 not equal to 0 and everyone else 0. And now I'm saying that actually N2 is also relevant. When studying these spinons, N2 is also relevant. But N1 is huge. It's going to infinity. It's very large. And this guy is finite. It can be 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on. So the idea is we should take the limit where we put many, many particles of type 1. This we know, of course it's true, because the antiferromagnetic state has N1 equal L over 2, right? So we knew we have to put many of them. And now I'm telling you, you can also sprinkle a few N2s. Put 4 or 5 N2s or 6 or whatever you want, as many N2s as you might want. Okay?
So how do the eigenstates of these strings look like? So for instance, if I have a string with 4 units, does it involve a state having group of three, then a spin up and a spin down as well?
Sorry, 4 units? You mean a string with 4 units?
Yes.
The wave function describes 4 particles. They have complex momenta. And therefore, the wave function, what happens is it's very small as soon as any particles deviate from the configuration where they are all close to each other.
Okay. But those states are in principle there?
Those states are known, yeah. Those states are there, but basically we don't need them for this case. Another way of saying is that you see that as soon as you study a string of type 2, it's easy to imagine that I already went to the complex plane, now I can put several of these objects together to get the other ones. So what's hard is to do the first step into the complex plane, to put two roots. Then if we want, we can put many of these guys, and this gives the bigger strings. Okay, this is indeed correct. Okay, so we start with just N1 and N2. Now. Okay. Good. So you see that, okay? And again, let me write, can I write here? Here is okay? Yeah? So we are going to do N1 equal L over 2, N2 equal to 0. This was the vacuum, right? So in this case, what happened was that QJ took values minus L over 4 plus a half, L over 4 minus a half. Okay, so when it turned down, I always forget, but let's check that this is correct. So the total number of slots that I have is twice this plus 1, right? It's twice L over 4 minus 1 half plus 1, which is L over 2. So I have L over 2 slots, and I need to put L over 2 particles, so everyone is occupied. Then we said, the next case we did was N1 equal L over 2 minus 1. We say we put one less guy, and N2 equal to 0. In this case, right? In this case, we said that QJ, we said that QJ belongs to minus L over 4, L over 4. The reason being that we get less, we get more space now, right? Which means that the number of slots equal twice this plus 1, so it's L over 2 plus 1. So you get one more slot, but N1 is L over 2 minus 1, and therefore we have two holes. Now, the next case we could do, is consider the case where we have N1 equal, so we can put one string of type N2. So we say we put N2 equal to 1. And I want to stay in the antiferromagnetic total spin 0. So I should put here L over 2 minus 2. This is what I want to do if I want to have spin 0, right? Because now the total number of particles is still the same. Okay? Now, because I am putting in practice as many particles as before, right? Because I'm putting as many particles as before in my BT equation, when I take the log and do the analysis of max and min, I get the same thing as here for the equations of type 1. So now I should be more careful. I should say, what about QJ, the Qs, for the strings A equal to 1? Because now I have two different types of strings, I should be more careful. Those, their equations, they contain as many roots as before, so they belong to the same set as above, minus L over 4 plus 1 half, L over 4 minus 1 half. So there are L over 2 slots, right? So the number of slots is equal to L over 2, right? But I have L over 2 minus 2 particles, so the conclusion is that we also have two holes in this case, right? The equations also have two holes. And then there is this equation, which is just one root, which reads, let me call the corresponding root, let me call it u bar, like we did yesterday. No, this is a string. Let me call the center of mass capital U. Capital U plus I over capital U minus I to the power L, right? Times the product of the S matrix involving 1 and 2 of U minus the other guys, UJ, where J runs from 1 to L over 2 minus 2 equal to 1. Right? This is what we would get. Okay. More generally, even more generally, just to complete what we would get, if we have n2, if it's bigger or equal than 1, we would denote the corresponding center of mass by capital U1 up to capital UN2. And what would be the equation that these guys would obey? It would obey the following equation. L times logarithm of U1 plus UJ plus I over capital UJ minus I, right? Plus, L over I, plus 1 over I times the interaction of the roots UJ with the fundamental roots, so that's 1, 2 of UJ minus small uk, where k runs from 1 to the number of roots of type 1. But now there are many, so there is also an extra term that was not there. Logarithm of the S matrix of type 2 with type 2 that we also computed. UJ minus U capital K, where now K is not equal to J and runs up to N2. Right? And this should be equal to 2 pi times an integer, n to j. Okay? So the basic idea now is the following, is find one, we have to find the density rho, right? That depends on what? It's a function of u, and it depends on the position of the holes, theta j, and on the position of these capital U's, uj. So we have to find this density, right? And then we have to find the equations for the holes and for the center of mass positions of the finite number of strings that we have. Yeah? So let me remind you that before this guy was what? It was 1 over cosh in Fourier. I'm doing in Fourier now. 1 over 2 cosh of omega over 2, that was the vacuum. And then each of the delta functions, it gave me some e to the I omega theta j divided by 1 plus e to the minus absolute value of omega. This was from doing 1 over 1 plus the kernel acting on the delta function whose Fourier transform is just an exponential. So this was the density before without use. Do you agree? This is just with thetas. But now we can change that equation. Let me change it and let me already prepare here. I will add in green plus the contribution from the UJs. So let's do it. I'll go there. I'll do it in a different color, actually.
Should I think of this bigger hole as a bound state of the simple holes or a new fundamental particle?
How you should think of this capital U?
Yes.
No, that's what we are going to understand now. I have to finish the computation, then we'll interpret the final result and you will see what it is. Okay. Yeah, I need to continue a bit more. Okay. So what changes here in this equation? Let's modify it here. So this kernel here in this equation now is the kernel 1, 1 with index 1, 1. Right? And there is the interaction of root u with root of type 2. So there is minus also, let me write it here in this color, minus the sum of k 1, 2 evaluated at u minus capital UJ. Because these numbers are finite, so this is basically this. So tell me if you agree with this. See? This is because the equation for particle of type 1, what does it contain? It contains 1 with 1 or 1 with 2. And then when I take the derivative of that equation, 1 with 1 gives kernel convoluted with density. But 1 with 2, it is just an interaction of u with a bunch of capital U's. So I just take the derivative, I get the kernel of 1 and 2. Okay? Is it clear? So now you see, this guy becomes a source here, right? Becomes a source. I already computed it in Fourier. It's here in Fourier. So the extra term we get, it's the usual story. We just write it in Fourier. So we have plus a sum of a function whose Fourier transform, I sum up to n2. What's the Fourier transform? We write the quantity in Fourier, e to the minus omega over 2 plus e to the minus 3 omega over 2. That's that quantity in Fourier, this k12. I put it on the other side. We computed it there. And this quantity, we multiply by this 1 over 1 plus k, which is 1 plus this. Right? So this quantity, this quantity here, gives me nothing but e to the minus. There's something I did wrong. No, everything is good. E to the minus absolute value of omega over 2, right? But that's just the Fourier transform of 1 over u minus capital U j square plus 1 quarter. So the so we have a 1 over Cauchy density, and then in Fourier, I'm doing in Fourier. Sorry, so I don't have Fourier here. And if you want to know what it is in position space, this is the Fourier of this. Okay, so this is already good. It's already in Fourier. Okay, but then if I have in Fourier, I should put plus I omega capital UJ. Okay, like here I add this. Is it clear? Now that we have this, let me tell you, let's see how these equations would be modified. Now that we have rho, we can first compute the energy. Right? The energy. What's the energy now? The energy is the sum of the energies of strings of type N2, sum over N2, 1 over capital UJ square plus 1 with some lambda. Right? Plus lambda times the integral rho of V times 1 over V square plus 1/4 with some lambda here. Yeah. Or and minus here, right? Lambda was negative. Was it minus? Okay. And this will give what we had before, 2 log 2 times L, that times lambda, that's the ground state energy, plus there will be a sum over as many holes as we have, the energy of the spin and of the holes, right? This follows the same thing. And now the next thing we have is the contribution of the density from this guy, which has Fourier transform, whose Fourier transform is e to the minus absolute value of omega. And this guy, where I remind you, the Fourier transform of this guy, that contribution there is e to the minus absolute value of omega over 2. And this guy, e to the minus absolute value of omega over 2. This is from the UJ part of the density, right? We plug the density and we look at the UJ part. So you see that this and this, they have the same Fourier transform. Exactly the same Fourier transform. So if I'm carefully with signs, it means that the result either doubles this or cancels it, actually. Okay? And the claim is that it cancels, I don't know, plus zero. Okay? And what I want to say here is that the strings UJ carry no energy. Okay? So yeah, I'm not sure if I got the minus sign here missing. Right now, I think I'm getting twice from that contribution. I'm getting twice this, but maybe not. I was not 100% careful with the signs. Let me see. So there I get minus there. I put it on the other side. I get plus. That kernel is dead, so rho is plus. And then the energy when rho is positive, I get some energy, which is lambda. Lambda is negative. And then I put more particles. Plus. L well, k. K is the derivative with respect to u.
Why do you want to put it to the other side?
Because, I don't want to put it to the other side. Good. Yeah, Dali Mill pointed out correctly. I want to put the k with rho to the other side, not that term. So indeed, I missed a minus one here. Okay? And now, with that minus one, I get minus here. And these two, they cancel precisely. Okay? So these uj's, they don't have energy, so they don't change the energy of the state. And the energy of the state is still given by this expression as before. However, these uj's, they affect the energy indirectly because they affect the equations for this theta j, and as we'll see now. Okay? So this is the first thing that we see. We see that they carry no energy. Okay? The second thing we can see, we can compute, let's check. What's the equation for this uj? The equation for this uj, what I need to do is take this term here, right? I need to take this term to simplify this equation. I want to take this term here and replace it by 1 over I integral rho of v times log of S12 of u minus v. Right? I just want to compute that S, and now the u's, I integrate them like that. Okay? And that, you see that by the structure of this of the density, this will give me a function of u. So this is evaluated at capital U. It will give me a function of capital U, j, plus, from the term of the density that contains theta, another function f2 of capital U, j minus theta k, with a sum over k, plus another sum of another function f3 of U, j minus U, k, from the term that contains the U, j. Do you agree that this is the structure of that integral there? Because rho is a function plus a function of uk plus a function of capital uk, of theta plus a function of u. So from the form of the density, right, this is the density. So from the form of the density, we get that structure there. Right? So what will happen is that that term, you see, because of that structure, it will change the effective moment of the particles, right? Because there will be an F1 of u that would change this. So F1 changes this term, right? Then there is a term with u and theta k. So this F2, it's new. It's a new object that was not there before. And that F3 modifies this term. F3 changes this interaction. Right? Okay. Now, let me just hint about how the computation goes. So now it's simple, right? So what is this S12? This S12 is what we wrote there. So let's do it in a, let's do a couple of them. Let's do F1. Let's see what F1 is. For F1, let's take the derivative. We take d du of that expression, and then we integrate back. But when we take d du, we get the kernel k12, e to the minus omega over 2 plus e to the minus 3 omega over 2. This is from the kernel k12. I took derivative, so it became the kernel. I also divide by 2 pi to get really the kernel. then I integrate back. So this is K12. Okay, this is for F1. And then there is rho, and rho contains this 1 over 2 cos omega over 2. Okay? And this gives me e to the minus omega over 2. Or not? No, it gives me e to the minus omega. Yeah, it gives me e to the minus omega. Do you agree? Such that, I'm sorry, I forgot something. What did I forget here?
L.
L. So we get L. So this term, after I integrate back, gives me L times log of capital U plus I over capital U minus I. Because it's with 1, so it's this. So what will happen is, for the same reason that the energy canceled, this term will cancel this term completely. Okay. So it changes it very much to the extent that it just kills it completely. Okay? The sign, okay, I'm not careful about the sign, but you see that it will either cancel or double, and I'm telling you again, it cancels. Okay? What about S22? So for this F3, the F3 part, I do the same thing, right? I do the same thing, so I have that F3 over there, whose Fourier transform we saw was just e to the minus absolute value of omega over 2. That's there in the bottom from rho. And from S12, I get the same thing as here, e to the minus absolute value of omega over 2 plus e to the minus 3 absolute value of omega over 2. Okay? Which is equal to e to the minus absolute value of omega plus e to the minus 2 absolute value of omega. Which is almost K22. You see, you get the 2 and the 1. Did I put the 2 and the 1? Yeah, I put the 2 and the 1. It's almost K22 except for the 2. Right? So what happens is that it almost cancels K22, but it leaves one term here. Okay, so it almost cancels, so it changes this term, and the equation we get, where do I still have space? I have 10 minutes. Can I write here, or it's too much? The equation for S1, instead of S22, I get UJ, no, I want to write it up there. So we are modifying this equation. We are finding now that in the spin and domain here, in this spin and part, we have an equation that tells me that uj minus uk plus I over uj minus uk minus I, that's the effective interaction that we got. K not equal to j, right? Because we canceled the square, we canceled the 1, and we got just one term like this. And then there is F2. Let's see if we can do F2 finally. F2, which is the new term. Now with experience, we can almost do by head, right? So F2 is basically just this, right? And I multiply by K12, cancels this denominator, and gives me what? So it's the same computation as here. So we have the same kernel, but now it multiplies by this, which is 1 over 1 plus e to the minus absolute value of omega. So this is F2, which is equal to e to the minus omega over 2. So because of the omega over 2, it gives me, I'm going to copy this term because I want to write it in a slightly different way. So this term that we just saw is uj minus uk minus I, uj minus uk plus I. This is going to be equal to 1. And here I'm going to write the other one. And the other one is a product of uj minus theta k plus I over 2 over uj minus theta k minus I over 2. So this product up to m, this product up to n2, which we should find a better name, but OK, for now, n2. So this is a set of coupled equations that give us the interaction, the equations for the center of mass of these strings, the way they interact with the holes. Okay? And what about the equation there? We have that term over there, k12 of u minus v, right? And we have also k12 times rho. So we also have to modify, finally, this equation here. And there will be a new term here, which will be the product up to n2 of theta j minus capital UK minus I over 2 divided by theta j minus capital UK plus I over 2.
So what are the indices of the index of the product, the first product?
Sorry?
What are the indices of the first product?
Sorry, the first product, product over K. So we got this new set of equations. Here is one equation. Here is this equation in this box. And here is this other equation. So here, j runs from 1 to the number of holes. And here, j, we have one equation for each root of type n2. And the energy is exactly the same energy as before. These guys don't carry energy. And now, the spin, and we will check now, it's m over 2 minus n2, which now allow us to study the full Hilbert space and not just the one where you increase away. In particular, let's see, the case where you put here m equals to 2 and n equals to 1 is exactly this case here, when n2 is equal to 1, and this is describing a state with 0. Okay? A state with where this combination here is 0. Okay? Okay. So let me now just tell you what we have. Okay, let me anticipate something and I'll summarize again. Tomorrow I'll start by summarizing what the result is. But the basic punchline is that what we are uncovering here is that these spinons are, honest to God, spin one-half particles that can have spin up or spin down, not just spin up. So by starting with antiferromagnetic vacuum, we are starting with a vacuum that does not break any symmetry. It respects all the symmetries, very different from the ferromagnetic vacuum, where we chose one direction to, say, point up, point down. Here, no, we start with a singlet. There is no, we did not break any SU2 symmetry. Then our excitations, they must transform under some representation of SU2, because we did not break the symmetry. So it's not like they just are scalars that carry some spin one half. No, they are really spinners, one, two-component spinners. And when the spinons scatter, I can first start putting, let me put all these spinons with spin up and let them move and scatter with each other and so on. That's what we saw before. What we saw today is, let me put all of them up and then flip some of them down. And now let those spins down move within the sea of the spinons like spin waves. And those are what these U's are. These U's is first we put M of them up and then we flip some of the spin ends down. And then you see these equations here. Suppose you put the theta j's to zero. You say the particles are very slow. The spin ends are almost not moving. Let's put this theta to zero. I remind you, when theta equal to zero, the momenta is zero, right? Our tangent of sinh of zero is zero. So let's put this theta to zero. What do we get here? We get uj plus I over 2 over uj minus I over 2 to the power m times this product equal to 1. It's exactly these equations here, where here I have m and here I have n2. Which makes total sense, because the spin-ends are all quiet. They're all spinning, pointing up. And then I flip n over 2 of them down and let them move in the sea of spins. All right? And then these spin waves just move, and they scatter with each other with the usual SU2 scattering matrix that we find here. And when the thetas are not exactly zero, but they are where we wake them up, now the propagation is a little bit different, because the spin chain is not quiet, it woke up a little bit. So going around the ring now means interacting with each impurity, which is this theta here. Okay? Similarly here, if I go here, and if I say I ignore the term with N2, then I get just a spin and propagation. But otherwise, I have some interaction between the physical moment of the particle and the spin wave moment of the system. So we have two types of waves going on in my system. I have particles that if I put them radioactive, I would see some points blinking and moving, real physical particles that are moving. These are the thetas. And spin waves, which are the U's, which are even ignoring the fact that they are physically moving. The spins can be all pointing up, and then one guy points down, the other points down, and I can have a spin wave moving on the spin chain. And what's the energy of the particle, of the spinon? Well, it doesn't care if the spinon is up or down. So that's why it better be that these UKs do not contribute to the energy. The energy is just the energy of each of the particles, be it spin up or spin down, it doesn't matter. Of course, if you consider a state with U's or without U's, because you have to solve these two coupled equations, the thetas will change and the spectrum will change. But the energy as function of the thetas should never depend on the U's, because they are just spin waves. So what we found was now the full treatment of the spinons as spin 1/2 objects, where we have waves and spin waves, and where now from this equation we could reverse engineer and extract the S matrix, really a matrix of the spinons, because now we see that they are spin 1/2 and carry degrees of freedom. So next time what we will start is recalling what we did. Extract that S matrix, really matrix, of the spinons from these equations. And the first thing we do when we extract this S matrix is check that it obeys Young-Baxter. And then it will close this loop of ideas where we have Young-Baxter appearing for the R matrix. And now at the end of the day, the Young-Baxter will appear for the S matrix of the spinon. Okay, sorry for going a little bit over time.